Are there any, have had time to reflect and discuss it over the break? Any questions or comments on what we covered last hour?
Well, let me just say as a footnote to it that I think a part of the work of the gospel of preaching in this generation is going to be to try to restore proper biblical masculinity and femininity in our churches, in our families, institutions. Well, look at the secondary purpose of marriage, procreation. This is important, but not the only purpose for marriage. Ephesians 6 gives us a commandment about raising children. We're going to come back to that. It's an important part of marriage. Genesis 1:28, multiply and replenish the earth. Here, let's look at the implication, and then we'll discuss it. While the sexual union of a man and a woman is beautiful and honorable, Hebrews 13:4 says that marriage is honorable and the bed undefiled. Sexual gratification was not designed as an end in itself. We must recognize the universal principle, now this is very important, that God's best for man is realized in those areas in which man gives himself for others rather than to and for himself. Because we're in the image of God, and God is the God of love and grace. So that sexual gratification is not an end in itself. Sex, as we've already said, the primary purpose of sex is to express intimate fellowship, divinely ordained intimate fellowship. However, that is not the only purpose of sex. As we know, if you know anything about biology, that sex often produces or children, little ones. Sex is not a privilege without responsibility. Now, question, what are the proper motives for having or not having children? Now I'm not talking about a case where a couple has no choice, where they simply are not able to have children. But would you say that it is always wrong for a couple to remain childless? It's always wrong if they can have children. I think not. But we would recognize, would we not, that those are special reasons. And often the reasons that a person would have for not having children would be the same reason he would have or she would have for staying single. Now this would be a matter of conscience and choice, but I'll give you an example, and this is not made up. I know many missionaries, I'm a Churchill relative of some, who have had a great deal of trouble in their families because of the difficulty that's created by raising children in some parts of the world, where there are no good schools, and this is a real source of trouble, where the children have to be sent off to academies in another country or another part of the country, and be away from the family and come and visit on holidays to get their primary and secondary education. That isn't the only cause. But, therefore, I would conclude that if it were a matter of conscience, that couples often, or it might, and I know some have, choose to remain childless simply because they are going to give their lives in a part of the world where it would be very unfair to the children, and so they are very difficult. Those are unusual circumstances. Well, you understand, even that is very rare, even among missionaries. There might be legitimate reasons, but selfishness is not a good reason. People today are afraid of having children, want children, and those who do want children don't want very many children. And this is a very iffy thing. This is touchy, and it's a matter of taste, and it overlaps with morals. But let me speak here to the attitude. You see, there are many reasons for not having children, which are legitimate reasons. We would recognize that. There are some reasons for not having children, which are not legitimate. There are some reasons for having a very small family, one child, or two. When do you start limiting the family? Well, whatever we choose in this, whatever we choose, let's make sure that our motive is not selfishness. For instance, it is one thing to, because we all want to limit our families, but our culture is a selfless culture. You know that, don't you? The real God is me, you and self and I. It's an eternity. It's through the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And this spills over in the child, and it creates a very poor attitude. Now, again, this is a matter of opinion. But, look at a family in our church. They're having their fourth child. Delightful couple. And their fourth child. And their little ones running around. They're good parents. And I looked at them the other day, and I thought, man, that's a lot of kids. And then it dawned on me, that's exactly how many we have. Somehow our four didn't seem like their four. Their four seemed like so many, and ours didn't seem like very many at all. I've seen families have large families that were under control, and they were delightful families. I've seen a man who could control six children by clearing his throat. And other men couldn't control one by screaming at the top of his voice. They couldn't even get a handle on one. Now, let me just give an opinion. I think that the thinking which says all the modern family must be a small family. You know what the average household is today? Every number of children is something like 1 3/4, or 1 or 2 and 1/9, something like that, child. Let me just, without getting into deep water, let me just say that kind of thinking very easily lends itself to the modern selfism of the age. And if we choose to go that route, we must not be sure it's not for that reason. Now, there are all kinds of reasons. How many children do you have? How do you limit it? There are some factors. Let's just go back to our primary question. What are proper motives for having or not having children? Well, a motive that is not healthy is, I'm not saying it's a deep sin, but it's not healthy, is, well, my wife and I want to be free and independent. We want to take vacations every year to the French Riviera. We want to put our money in real estate. There's not diapers. And we still wish I had any kids. Well, that's a very, somebody's that selfish. I don't want to be around them. On the other hand, the other extreme is, I've seen families who have had 6 or 7 children when 3 or 4 is all they could afford to raise. And the children, and it creates a very bad situation. So there needs to be a proper balance. But we cannot live away from the fact that, how shall I state this, that if we get married, a couple who has no children, for any number of reasons, maybe they just got married, they haven't started their family yet, maybe they can't have children, maybe they're delaying their family. We delayed our family. We were married 3 years before our first child was born because I was still an undergraduate school and it was really tough, and so we timed our first child so that she was born after I graduated. She was born in August after I graduated in June. So there's that period when people are saying, we're going to have a family, but we're going to wait a while. But that single couple in and of itself is a full marriage, you understand? Fulfilling the purpose of God. You don't have to have children to have a marriage in the mind of God. But having said that, when we move from that to the question of are we going to have children and how many we're going to have, then we need to recognize the fact that God created marriage for intimate fellowship, but also in a secondary way, as I understand the scriptures, for procreation, which means if we choose not to have children,
We should make sure that our reason is a good reason that God will accept. And if we choose to have a very small family, one child, let's make sure it's for the right reason, not simple selfishness. Is this making sense to you? Because what happens is, what comes into play, the question becomes not, well, how many children do you have? The question becomes, what is your attitude? What kind of attitude do you have? Now, listen to me, but see, raising children, being married, and having children is the essence of otherism. Our culture preaches selfism. The question comes, is joy found in selfism or in otherism? What does the Bible teach? The Bible teaches, this is very important, students, that we are in the image of God, and because we're in the image of God, we are going to be happier with the life that is based on giving rather than the life that is based on taking. The only statement of Jesus that's not recorded, it is in the Bible, but it's not in the gospel narratives, is what? The book of Acts is more blessed to give than to receive. It's a happier thing to give than to receive. Why? Because we're in the image of God. Selfism is not the road to happiness. And being a good mate means that you have to sublimate, you have to subjugate self to the interests of the other. The question cannot be, what do I want? What's going to make me happy? What do I need? I see so many selfish people. And I tell you, some men are so selfish, I just want to take them by the back of the neck and shake them. Almost have a couple of times. And having children is the essence of selfishness. If you're a selfish person, you know it. You need to either repent and change or don't have children. Because children is it requires, unless you inherited $1 million, it requires a lot of sacrifice to have children. A lot of energy and money and time goes to bringing up a family. On the other hand, it is a source of joy. This is a very simple psychological fact. Let me ask you, this is a good test, a good litmus paper test. At Christmas time, which makes you happiest, the gifts you receive or the gifts you give? Now, if the gift that you receive, that's your great joy, then you need to get along your closet center and ask God to help you change your heart. You see, Mary, Christmas at our house is a huge thing. It's one of the big days in the year. We act a complete fool. We plan our foolishness well in advance. And I never preach sermons against materialism. Preachers have their standard sermon against, Christmas has become materialistic. I never preach that because I'm the biggest sinner of all. And there's no sense adding hypocrisy to my holiday materialism. But it's really funny, around the tree, this is how it goes. You husband's one of those families, they'll get a gift. And they'll, a little bit, and of course, it's always amazing how it always seems to match. Remember last year, one gift, my wife is the engineer on shopping, so you buy clothes that one buys matches what somebody else bought. And the person that gets the gift, they're happy, enjoy it. But when the other person is opening the gift that they gave, that's when the foolishness begins. They go in and they hover, and they wring their hands, and while you're open, I get this is for me. And you like it, and I know I shop for this, and look how this fits, and so there's a little bit of delight in what they get, but there's the huge delight, the real joy comes in the ones they gave. Isn't that true? Why is that? There's no logic to that. I'll tell you one thing, evolution sure can't explain it. Why? Because we're in the image of God.
And God so loved that he gave. And family business is the business of giving. And children is the business of others and of giving. And a lot of children are ruined because of selfish parents. They want to have the children, but they don't want to give the time. And it's great joy. I know some couples who are childless because they're so selfish. And they're getting along fine now, but they're going to have a mighty miserable old age. They're going to be alone. I expect to spend my old age griping about my grandkids who are bothering me and being all kinds of trouble. I plan on spending my old age knee-deep in people, wading through them, telling them to get out of my way and leave me alone, and are they coming again, and how am I going to feed that bunch, and the bigger the better. I don't want to spend my old age in a condo overlooking the ocean clipping coupons. Did you ever try to kiss a coupon? Have I made that clear? We're talking about attitude. Any questions or comments on this? Things hard to nail down. Have I made my point clear? Yeah. It doesn't mean we've got to have 16 kids or anything like that. And I think moderate, what do you think is the ideal size for a family? Four. Why four? How many were in your family? See, that's why. Whatever you grew up with, if you were one of two, you tend to think two's about right.
Yeah,
don't
have three. That's all I
do
always.
Yeah.
So three is that.
No, it's a. I got three of them now. Is it all right that they're planned? I mean, how are you going to have the wife probably agreeing if she has another trip later on, she can go on and find out a girl on the third one. That's as far as we go, and she gets a girl on the next try. That's
and Anthony's supposed to be a girl.
Well, but you might change your mind. But again, it depends. You know what I'm saying? Depends on your.
As long as both agree.
Yeah, right. And it's for the right reason. It's not just selfishness.
No,
it may just be wisdom. And when does it stop being selfish and begin being wisdom? I can't answer that. I'm giving you the principles. We have to be honest before God. In other words, you might say, well, if you only have two, that's less selfish than having four. But we had four. You could say, well, that's six. You see, you could draw the line anywhere and get very judgmatic and legalistic. That's not what I'm talking about. There are some disadvantages. This is a side issue. Children who grew up in larger families often have more well-rounded experiences than those who grew up in very small families. I feel sorry for only children. Because they don't learn how. Only children tend to grow up to be selfish. It's hard for an only child not to grow up to be selfish, simply because they didn't have to share. They were the center of attention, and they have a tough time. You grew up as one of four. You're saying I'm one of six, but I'm actually only one of four because, well, there are six of us. The last two were born after I'd already grown up and moved away. So I only actually lived with my experience was one of four. And my wife is one of five who lived. She was one who didn't live. But they were all together, closer together. And we planned on four from the beginning. It worked out ideally. We had our two girls and we had our two boys. It doesn't always work that way. But we just wanted four. It's purely a matter of. Now, let me tell you, it's interesting. If you have one, two is a huge jump over one. But three and four, once you have two, having three or four doesn't really, it's not that much difference. you sort of get organized. At least you should anyway. Let me tell you this, by the way. This is looking ahead to the part we're going to talk about in detail. But the secret to having to enjoying your children, whether you have, as I said, I know people have one, can't control one. I've seen people with five and six, and they're in trouble at all. The key word is control. If you can control a situation, you can enjoy your children. If you can't control it, you can't enjoy it no matter how many kids you have. Right? You got to have control of the situation. The ship has got to stay afloat. Things have got to work. Not chaos. And anybody have anything else to say on that? Yes?
Not really right along the same track, but I have a question that goes to 22:15.
Okay.
But when you shall be preserved, you will bear the children of Israel to the faith of God and thank you for today. In terms of procreation being secondary, I don't understand that word.
Okay. You see what she's asking? It was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman, being quite deceived, fell into transgression. But women shall be preserved through child, but through the bearing of children, if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. So what are you asking?
I don't understand how are women preserved through childbearing? What is Paul saying?
I see. I've got an answer I want to give you, but could I give you an answer next time we meet? I'd like to think about that to review. Okay. Okay. That's a good question. I don't want to give you. It's a tough text, and I've got some things in my mind, but I don't want to. Give you a flippant answer. By the way, let me, in your syllabus that you bought while we're talking about, before we get too far from the event, you did not have a reading. This is not in your syllabus, is it? You bought Intimacy, Our Latest Sexual Fantasy. It's not in your syllabus? Okay, I'm going to put this in the, I'm going to assign this as a reading. I'm going to put some copies in the library. Excellent article. Christianity Today, January 16th, 1987. Okay, I'm going to put this in the library for reading. I came upon this and reproduced it after I had already put the syllabus together and got the class flow. That's why. We'll just make a note that you'll be responsible. Pardon?
January
16th, 1987. Let me come back to you on that.
Okay.
Okay. Now. We look at conflicting views in the early Christian centuries. Asceticism, as you know, we look at the biblical plan, the biblical ideal. Masar, were there any more questions before you moved away from procreation? Okay. And there, as you know, this is an overlap with the course in early Christian centuries, that this Greek dualistic view, which promoted asceticism, the view that evil inheres in the physical, that evil is a quality of the physical world, led to asceticism, the mortification or subjection of the physical. You all know what the word asceticism means. Okay. Sex, this view, which I explain here in the syllabus, which is not new to you, various groups, like the Gnostics, viewed procreation as an act which brought souls into the bondage of the flesh. The objection to procreation often was justified by reference to the immediate return of Jesus. So in the early church, they came up a view that there were two reasons why there was an objection to having children. One, the Lord is coming back soon, but that was a minor one. The other one was that, although I don't know what that would have to do with anything, the other one was that sex is evil and you bring children into the bondage of the flesh. This world is so evil. The Lord is coming back soon. Maybe the two were tied together. In any case, why subject children to the misery of being in the human flesh? Many of the church fathers, I'm reading now, also adopted negative attitudes toward the sexual aspect of marriage. Tertullian remarked, marriage, forsooth, is better because burning is worse, but much better neither to marry nor to burn. Now Paul said, better to marry than to burn, because he meant burn with passion. He said, yes, better to marry than to burn, but really it's really better to do neither. Well, that's a very negative attitude, not very realistic. Christians in Syria adopted Encratite views, which promoted spiritual marriages without sexual relations. Hey, like, that's sort of one step away from being a monk. You get married, but you don't have sex. Which is, doesn't work very well, I wouldn't think. Can you imagine that? But that shows that very that dualism, that aesthetic view. What was that? Let's not get crude now.
No, I think all the guys that were married.
No, that's right. No. Yes, we don't have to put that to a vote, do we?
That's an inherent
evil. I was in a guest speaker at a church back in the early 60s down in Texas, and there was a lady led the choir, and since I was just passing through, the preacher told me that this couple had been married for 16 years and their marriage had never been consummated. They lived with her parents, and of course I took one good look at her and it sort of made sense. But I didn't. It's hard to believe the idea that you could actually, you know, anybody would actually do that. Well, this, yeah. This trend. Well, while we're being ridiculous, I had a friend. He was preaching in Johnson City, Tennessee, so he isn't there now, so you wouldn't know who he is. Several years ago, he was a young preacher, and this guy came to him and was counseling, and this guy had been married to this woman for some months, years, a good while, and she had never let him near her. And he had tried everything. He had gone to counselors, and so, you know, he had suggested all kinds of courting and persuasions and counseling, and nothing was working. And finally one day the guy just came into his office and plopped down and he said, "What do I do now?" And the preacher, before he thought, said, "Well, have you tried rape?" which showed his frustration as well as that of the young husband. Of course he was not seriously counseling that. Well, that seems, my point is, this has a sober point. That's a very unrealistic thing, isn't it? But that shows how that false worldview can express itself. This trend led to exaggerated regard for virginity and celibacy as the more virtuous life. Now, reference was made to 1 Corinthians 7:25, where Paul recommends remaining single. But we understand, do we not, there, that in that, that is prefaced by the condition which he calls the present distress. He is not saying remain single because it is inherently more spiritual. He is saying you might want to remain single for now because of the present distress. This is not a good time to start a family. You understand? So that has nothing whatever to do with an intrinsic spirituality in the celibate life. And we know that, and you've studied with me in early Christian centuries, the evolution of Mariolatry. And she became the perpetual virgin. In 8305, the canons of Elvira in Spain forbade members of the clergy, that was the bishop's conference, from having relations with their wives. This was on the way to celibacy. Got that? If you were a clergyman, you could not have sex with your wife. The Nicene Council in 325 ruled that no priest should marry after ordination. That is, if he was married when he was ordained, he could stay married, but if he were single when he was ordained, he could not marry. This is, again, this is on the road to celibacy. We're talking about conflicting views in the early Christian centuries. The other view also, and this is kind of crazy, but also based on this ascetic dualism, was licentiousness, which is a minority view. Gnostics such as Basilides and Carpocrates, who adopted licentious attitudes toward sex, offered as their rationale that their essential spiritual natures could not be contaminated by what was done in their physical bodies any more than pearls could be sullied by mud. You got that? You see, they say, well, the physical is evil and tainted and it's eternally, intrinsically separated from God. What do you do? Well, one would say, because it is intrinsically evil, you mortify it, subdue it, and deny it. Asceticism. Another would say, well, they would go the other way and say, since, this was another brand of Gnosticism, since the physical body does not count, it doesn't matter what it does. It is not connected with the spirit, like a pearl. You can throw a pearl in the mud, but the mud does not get into the pearl. Therefore, they could have free sex, do what they wanted to do, and did not affect their essential person or character because of this dualism. By the way, that is very close to holiness theology. Holiness theology is dualistic, they don't go that far. But it is based on the same approach, certain worldview. Such rationalization is clearly condemned by the biblical view that believers' bodies are the temples of the Holy Spirit. This is the context of the epistles of John, by the way, this view, this Gnosticism. Okay. Well, we look at those two conflicting views in the early church. That's just of historical interest. We come now to marriage in the framework of Christ's redemption. And marriage is, first of all, a divine vocation. It's a divine calling to a full-time vocation and a lifelong commitment. What God has joined together, we have read. Abraham's servant, who was sent to fetch a bride for Isaac, made his mission a matter of earnest prayer for divine guidance. It's recorded in Genesis chapter 24. Got that? He brought God into it. Christian men and women should do no less in regard to the subject of marriage. You get that? Well, if there's anything, it ought to be a subject of much prayer and even fasting. It ought to be marriage. Next to the decision to become a Christian, the decision of who you're going to marry is the biggie. And it's amazing how casually so many people enter into it. And some people just get lucky. But that's the most don't. By the way, I recommend, especially for men, before you decide to really marry somebody, you ought to fast for a week. You can see things more clearly. Sort of what it does enables you to see past the physical to see if there is a spiritual quality. Women too should do that to make a good sober decision. But we need to pray for divine guidance. Now I'm not saying, remember I've already talked against this Calvinistic concept, well, God has a mate picked out for you and you have to find who it is. God places. We're going to have a treasure hunt now. I'll give you a few clues along the way, but let's just see if you can find that booger. No, God doesn't do that. But we certainly do believe, I believe very firmly in providence. You can't be married to my wife that very long without believing in providence. And I think that both men and women should pray fervently for the guidance of God in the selection in a mate. Matter. Now, it doesn't mean that obviates the need for common sense and clear thinking, but God, but do you believe, don't you believe that? Providence.
Fair enough. Yeah, God works in ways to
opening doors to bring people together.
I think it's very likely.
And where you might not say A and B should be together, but now you're in a situation where you'd be able to choose a mate that is very suitable. Like
possibly, yes. Yeah, let me say this. A lot of guys put down, girls get put down a lot. Because why are you in Baba Kaur to find a husband? That's an unkind, unfair thing to say. But even if it were true, what's wrong with it? People don't do anything for any single reason. Here's a woman who wants to serve God. What better way to serve God than with a godly mate who believes what you believe and wants to serve God? There's nothing wrong with that. That's where I found my wife. Sure, exactly right.
God.
Doesn't always work out that way, but it's not a bad plan. Just a personal word. I believe that God providentially, I think God was involved in some way at least in my wife and I finding each other. It's just how it's worked out that the kind of work I'm in, the kind of work I do, which forced me to travel a lot and speak, is the very kind of work her father did. She was raised in that. And it's helped her to understand. Now, I'm not saying God did it that way. Maybe he did it, maybe he didn't. But I know it's been a wonderful help to me. A real help to me. She was an excellent preacher's wife. And when I got this kind of work, her daddy founded the Bible College, the College of the Scriptures in Louisville, Kentucky, her father. And so her father was always teaching and traveling and doing Bible College work. And it's been a tremendous aid to me. Because she understands. Now, that's good. You know, I'm not saying it had to be that way, or a woman coming from another background couldn't do it, because women do adjust and do a very good job. But that was nice, nothing else. And so we ought to make it a matter of prayer. Whether we marry at a particular time and who we marry. Any questions or comments on any further? It's a very personal thing. Well, Paul recognized that the calling to be married or to remain unmarried was, in either case, a gift. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 7:7. Now, Paul himself was unmarried. While we know him, had Paul ever been married? Probably was. If he was a member of the Sanhedrin, which he probably was, he had to be married. It was considered normal for the teachers, the men leaders, the rabbis in Israel to be married men. Maybe Paul had never married. Some suggest he was a widower. He never says so. We don't know. If he was ever married, he doesn't say so. But he makes it very clear that he said, I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. Now, Paul, this statement, I wish that all men were even as I myself am, has been taken by some critics of Paul to say that he is a woman hater. Well, you can't read the writings of Paul and write him off as a woman hater. Those who want to get rid of the doctrine of that the husband is the head of the house try to say, well, that was Paul's opinion and he was a woman hater. But you read Paul, some of the most glowing things Paul says, the highest honor he pays to women. You cannot find a more respect, Paul. You read the 16th chapter of Romans and other places. Paul clearly held women in high respect and high regard, and held marriage in high regard. But you understand when he says, I wish that all men were even as I myself am. That is a part of this discussion. Look at verse 26 of the same chapter. I think then that this is a good view. He's talking about not of staying single for a while. I think this is a good view of the present distress that it's good for a man to remain as he is. Understand? What he's saying is that part of that whole, when he says, I wish that all men were like I am, he is saying, under the present condition, that's a part of this discussion, that if right now, see, Paul, because of the distress that was upon the church, family life was difficult, he was saying, it's a lot easier for me, because I don't have to, I'm single, I can move, if I get killed, it's not going to leave a widow and children. Isn't that a consideration? Something like that? Suppose you're in a situation where the Jews were, where your life was threatened regularly. Would it be responsible for a man to marry a woman and give her and have a child or two, and then when he knows he could be killed, then where does that leave her? Oh no, it's better to want in present distress to remain single. But he says, it's a gift. Each man has his own gift from God, his own ability from God, one in this manner and another in that. But to the unmarried, to the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I, under the present distress. Now, any questions on it? It's a gift. Circumstances made such a choice expedient. He regarded this decision as a matter of sacrifice. Nowhere is it suggested that the single chaste state is inherently more spiritual than the marriage state. We've talked about this. Rather, marriage is offered as the normal state. Matthew 19:10-12 speaks of the sacrifice of the normal privilege. Let's turn to Matthew 19.
Doctor,
yes.
What do you think the impending distress was? Was it maybe?
It was the Jewish persecution of the church, and the impending, or even perhaps beginning, Roman persecution of the church there in Corinth. Government persecution.
Were they used against the family? Were they maybe torture somebody and try to get you to denounce Christ or what?
Well, there's some indication, such as the statement where he says, if any man only by the Spirit of Christ, a man can say Jesus is Lord, and man speaking by the Holy Spirit will not say Jesus is accursed. That suggests government persecution. Now, regardless, so what are you asking, the form it took?
Yeah, I mean, why would he make that kind of statement unless it was going to be something like, I'll torture your wife until you denounce Christ?
I don't think they would do that. I think mainly it was that for the Jews, the Jewish persecution, and some, for the Jews in the church there, Jim, often, if a man became a Christian, he lost his family, lost his, if he was a part of a family business, he had no income. Very often, when a Jewish man became, or a person, but particularly a man, became a Christian, he was without a job and a home. He had to get reestablish himself. That would certainly be a present distress. Get married without a job or a home, without any income. Secondly, I think it's mainly that the Christians, especially the men, were in constant danger of being put in jail or even put to death. And then, so they were under pressure by the Jews. The Romans let the Jews. Remember, Paul says how many times he received stripes? 39 times. How many times he received 39 stripes? 5 times, or however he says in 1 Corinthians 11. Where did he get those stripes? He got it from the Jews. Not the Romans, the Jews. So all I'm saying is that it was either the ability of the man to maintain a home financially, or even be there, you know, be exiled, executed, and of course that would also mean the same distress would be upon the women. We're not told the details, but there was obviously trouble. They were having a bad time of it. Now, let me just give you an example, Jim. We talk about reasons for remaining childless. Here's a couple who live in a communist country where the children are taken from the parents and put in state schools if they find out the parents are Christians. Would you have children, knowing the state was going to take them away and train them as atheists? Or would you just have the children? Would you say, well, I'm not going to have your children have that happen? Or would you would you say, well, I'm going to trust God? Have children anyway. I guess it'd be a tough decision. We see a parallel to this, by the way, in Russia. It's very often that a man who becomes a Christian, he loses his job, his state-appointed job, he loses all kinds of privileges. It happens all the time. One of the things that really gets me is that the news media focus on the plight of the Jews, those who want to leave, the Jews who want to leave Russia, and how the Jews are treated. Man, the Jews, and that's of course very bad, but the Jews have a picnic compared to how the Christians are experiencing in Russia. When they try to immigrate, the Jews get out easily compared to how Christians suffer and are kept in. But there would be an example of the same kind of thing, where here's a man who has to spend 6 years in Siberia in a camp, and when he gets back, he can't have a job. What about his family? Paul's saying, you might want to remain single if you can, but it's a gift. If you can't do it, go ahead and marry. Marriage is the normal state. And then we think of Matthew. Did I answer your question? I think of Matthew 19, 10 through 12. This is where Jesus says, the disciples said to him, if the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it's better not to marry. That is, if in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. And I did not want to speak off the top of my head because I wasn't real clear in my memory and studied this for a long time. So I asked for time, and Lori very graciously granted it to me. So, and I promise to respond with substance, which is what I'm doing now. Oh, do we understand what's going on? Thank you. The text says, talking about women, let's start with verse 8. Therefore, I want the men in every place to pray, lifting up holy hands without wrath and dissension. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as befits women making a claim to godliness. Let a woman quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. I do not allow a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet, somebody in the church. For it was Adam who was first created, and then Eve. It was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman, being quite deceived, fell into transgression. But, it's understood, shall be, women, understood, from the Greek text, shall be preserved through the bearing of children, if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. Now, what does it mean, this woman who is to be modest and submissive? What does it mean that even though Eve sinned initially, the woman shall be preserved through the bearing of children if they continue? Now, as you recall, that the pain in childbirth was the curse visited upon Eve and upon women because of Eve's sin. And is there a connection between, I think so, even though this a curse was brought upon women, the pain of childbearing, yet a woman, if she is a godly woman, will be preserved through childbearing. Now, what does that mean? Well, it's a tough text. What it literally says in the Greek is, she shall be saved through, in the Greek it's the genitive force, through the childbearing, literally. And the article seems to be significant in this context. That is literally what it says, she shall be saved through the childbearing. Now, there is two basic explanations. I'll give you the one I don't accept. And it is that she's saying that the refers to the birth of Jesus through the childbearing, like the day or the book, the one great childbearing. What this interpretation says, that what Paul is saying is, and I think this is possible. I don't like it, but I think it's possible that through the woman came grief and misery first, because she was tempted first. Yet through the great childbearing, there is salvation if one is, if they continue in faith and love and sanctity. That is, he's pointing out that through the woman came the birth of Jesus and therefore salvation. Now that is possible. That is a strained interpretation. It loads a lot on the Greek article on the childbearing. I'm not saying it's impossible. The other one is that it's the more straightforward explanation, that she shall be saved from physical dangers in spite of Eve's sin and the attendant penalty. That is, as the usual thing. He's talking about providence here. That is, this is one of these statements in Scripture which is not a guarantee but a principle. Like raise a child up in the way he should go, when he is old he will not depart from it. Well, has a child ever been raised up in the way he should go and then departed from it? Yes. He's talking about a principle, not a guarantee. And I think this is what he's saying here, that even though women share the burden of Eve, that if she is if she continues in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint, God will providentially guard her through the dangers of childbirth, which fits better with the grammar. Now, you understand two things. First of all, let me tie this together, Lori. The rest of you can listen in too if you want to. First of all, you must understand that for most of the history of the world, childbirth was an extreme danger for a woman. A lot of women died in childbirth. Not much has to go wrong in childbirth before a woman dies. Even with modern methods, it's a danger. Modern childbearing attended by medical technology. But it's a great danger. Secondly, to repeat myself, he was offering a principle, not a guarantee. He's speaking of providence. What he's saying is that if a woman, here's a woman, she comes to this point of extreme danger, which women were afraid of then more than they are now, where a breach or any kind of trouble, both mother and baby would die. A woman comes to this, if she's a godly woman, then she is in a position to pray. She's in a position for God providentially to preserve her. Now, it is not a guarantee. I'm saying that he's not saying, if this is the right interpretation, Laurie, he's not saying if you're a Christian, you've got a 100% guarantee against death and childbirth. It's simply the general biblical principle that those who are godly have the attention of God in a way that those who are ungodly do not. Providence.
So, you're saying that women shall be preserved through the actual delivery.
Yes, through this is the better grammar. It's not that you're interested. It's dia through, the childbearing is in the genitive. Therefore, through childbearing is the natural. It's not the only necessary. This is tricky, but that's the first normal, preferred understanding of it. Do I need to summarize as you get that?
I got it.
Okay. Just like any other thing, for instance, Paul was providentially preserved through many of his dangers because he was preaching the gospel. In one place he was raised from the dead. It doesn't mean he was perfectly safe. He was beaten up. He had trouble. But simply, I think it's talking about the matter of principle that the person who lived close to God is in a position to pray and ask for the special providential help in times of danger. And childbirth was a tremendous point of fear for women. Yeah, but again, not a. This is a common language. And Paul is a Jew speaking. Often, principles are stated as if they were guarantees. Would be if stated that way in modern English, like the one I mentioned, raise up a child the way he should go. A principle, not a guarantee. And we could give many other examples. Now, those are the two possible. The first one is attractive, but it's strained. Strains the grammar. That is, if Paul were going to say, even though all this trouble came through Eve, yet through the woman through the one great childbearing, the birth of Jesus, then salvation comes. I think he would have said it a different way. That's pretty indirect. Now, that doesn't prove it. It all depends on what the common vernacular was. That's a redundant term. What the vernacular was, how those things were spoken of in that day. If that was the normal way of referring to the birth of Jesus in the church, the great childbearing, then he could have been referring to that. We don't have enough information to know that. Okay?
Yeah.
That's a good, I didn't want to mumble and stumble about on that because my memory wasn't complete on that. Okay. Any other questions? Now, we're talking about this thing of childlessness, and well, we talked about that. Marriage as a divine vocation. Therefore, how does the single life, not childlessness, but how does the single or celibate life fit in? And we have established the biblical principle that while Paul and Jesus both teach that there are occasions for remaining celibate and single, that is not the normal state. It may be an expediency, but it is not intrinsically better to stay single than to marry. That is because sex and the physical stuff is evil, not in the Greek sense. So that's why he says, Paul makes it very clear that marriage is honorable among all men. The bed under this is a sacred thing, school, whatever your gift is. The implication is this. Now, all that I want to really focus on this, students. This is very important. One must not decide both to be married and to live a life that makes marriage difficult or impossible. That's what we must not do. A man may sacrifice his own, now look how I word this, a man may sacrifice his own legitimate sexual privileges, but he may not sacrifice his wife and children. Now this has many implications. We would think, say, if a man were going to be a missionary in a very dangerous part of the world where it was very primitive, like parts of Brazil or Papua New Guinea or someplace like that, he might choose either to remain single, or he might marry a woman and they choose to remain childless, at least during the term of service. But he might decide, the man, we're going to go into there. And by the way, this is not a hypothetical situation. In the history of the church, hundreds of men have done this. And some women have done it. Many women have done it. Understand? Gone into areas of great danger to preach the gospel and chose to be single for that reason. That is, they were willing to risk their life, but they were not willing to risk the lives of their wife and children. And many have given their lives. That is not, because our world has become more civilized, that is not, while that would be a regular thing in earlier periods of history, it is not the regular thing now. Well, what does this principle mean then? Well, I'll give you a couple of applications. First of all, a person can live a kind of life, and many evangelists are doing this, where they have a wife and a home and children, but are never there. They're in effect sacrificing the wife and children. Men often don't understand this. It's been a real, and this is no secret, and I'm not casting stones, I'm simply observing for our own education, that I had a revival meeting up in northern Indiana a couple of 3 weeks ago. And there I learned that a well-known traveling evangelist who I went to school with, very successful evangelist, baptized with several hundred people a year, has lost his family, divorced, and is remarrying. And he does not have scriptural grounds for a divorce. And many of our many traveling evangelists have lost their family, and many preachers have lost their families.
We didn't travel, but we were never home. And here's a man who, this one man I'm thinking of, he traveled at least 1 week out of the month, maybe two, he's gone all of it. And then for a couple of months a year, he'd go to another foreign country on mission work, and then he'd be gone. And let me just tell you this, and I'm not saying that's the only reason for the failure of his marriage, I don't know. I'm simply saying it's happened often enough, and you probably know examples of it. That the rule is this, and especially the men, the women end up getting left home. Fellas, God does not give you the right to sacrifice your family to serve the Lord. It doesn't pay off anyway, because, hear me, if you lose your family, you're going to lose your ministry. For all practical purposes, at least in most cases. That is, I have friends who lost their family simply because they never were home, didn't take care of them, didn't take care of business at home. But what were they doing? Well, they were serving the Lord in their ministry. But fellas, if your children turn out rotten and you cannot keep your wife happy and your family falls apart, nobody's going to pay much attention to you as a minister anyway. You've lost your influence. Because you see, the home is so important to people. The home is under pressure, under attack. The home is disintegrating. People are looking to the minister, not just for lectures on the Christian home. People are looking to the minister for a model. And one of the most important things you can do in our world, in America, people, men and women, is to let the parsonage home be a good, sound Christian home that people can see who don't know otherwise don't see one. And without saying a word, you'll have a tremendous influence. Take my word for it. People would see if your family works, you're going to have people coming to you. In fact, they'll take up your time saying, "How do I see your family works. How are you doing that?" And you have a perfect witnessing opportunity, which is better than getting up in the pulpit. I know preachers get up in the pulpit and regularly blast out at people because of their families aren't working, and his own family is in a sorry state. And people know that. It's amazing how many books are written on child care, child raising by people whose kids are rotten. I mean, I saw a book recently, fairly recently, a book written on how to raise children by a guy, one of his children was in jail. He's going to tell me how to raise my kids. It might be the greatest book in the world. I'm not going to pay attention to it. Just the psychological. I caught a guy, we were still up on Orlando during the summertime. I caught a guy stealing gas out of my van and took his car keys so he couldn't leave. There were two of them. And Dean Chambers was with me, so they couldn't get their car keys back. We just those two snotty teenagers stood looking up at us and threatening us and everything. Anyway, finally the sheriff came, and I found out that the kid's mother, this kid had a rotten attitude. I mean, it took a lot of grace and mercy on my part not to knock his head off with the way he talked to me and everything. You know, he was calling stealing gas out of my car, and he talked to me like I was a criminal. Who do you think you are? I took his car keys, and he's taking my gas. Anyway, I took the car keys so he couldn't leave. Found out his mother is a youth counselor, was a youth counselor at the Presbyterian Church downtown. She's telling other people how to raise their kids, their own kids out stealing gas. I have a relative who's in ministry, whose children went very bad, and it really has hurt him. And I don't know, for God, whose fault it is. See what I'm saying? It is not serving God the way God wants to be served to be so busy out calling and preaching and planning and attending meetings so that your own family disintegrates. And it takes time. We're going to talk about make time to live later on. We'll just state the principle here that you do not get married and then live as if you're single. Now the last application I would make of this before we move on is that many people, especially men, but more women are doing it now, is that the question, it's not a matter simply a matter of time, but they have children, but they do not want to spend the energy it takes to raise them, and so the kids grow up like weeds in their own home, well-dressed,
weeds. That is, they want the children. Many parents, people today, young couples today, have children for the same reason that children want pets. You know, the pet, while the pet's a little puppy, it's darling, it's cute, but then it grows up and to be a big ugly dog, and nobody wants it. Every year, you know, they warn the public about buying baby ducks at Easter time, because little baby cute ducklings grow up to be messy, large ducks, and then people don't want them. Well, a lot of people have kids like they were pets, toys. Aren't they cute little darlings? They just is this little cuddly thing. But when it comes to paying the price and expending the energy to raise the kid to be somebody you can stand, they don't do it. They're too busy doing their own thing, whatever that thing is. And many men, I know personally, and I know from studies on the subject, many men will marry a woman and then live as if they were single. Gonna have, it's my money, and my money is my money, and you can take your chances. And I've got my hobbies, and I've got places I'm gonna go, and I'm gonna do my thing, and I'm gonna do what I'm gonna do, and as if he was not married. Listen, marriage is we business, not I business. Now, not that there aren't times when we enjoy an independent existence. We don't become completely one flesh to the extent that we're not individuals. But fellas, if you marry that woman, you are not a bachelor anymore. And don't live like one. And many men do. And some women do. Y'all know what I'm talking about? You'll see this in the church. Guys, even Christians, who don't know anything. They'll just have the attitude, in other words, have the single attitude. It comes out in all kinds of ways. Any questions on that or the point I'm trying to make or comment yet?
I want to ask you a question. We're talking about if you lose your family, you lose your ministry. I knew a minister who had a 17-year-old daughter, and she was babysitting a lot, getting pregnant. Well, the church told his minister that he didn't have his house in order because his daughter went out as a 17-year-old and got herself pregnant. And just missed it. Do you think that was right? I mean, where's the breakdown when you're held responsible and when you're not held responsible for your own kids?
The break comes, I think, while they're living in your home. Was she still living under the roof? And I take it he's responsible. A man is responsible for what goes on under his own house and his own roof. That's my answer. Whether that's the right answer or not, that's my answer to you. No matter how old the kids are, up to a point, of course, but, in those teen years. God holds a man responsible for his household, and she was a part of his household. Now, I'm not saying that justified what the church did. They could have been more forgiving and understanding. But you asked me about responsibility, and that's my answer to you. Okay, any other questions or comments on this? Do you understand the principle? Well, it's a matter of attitude. And I'm not making this up. It's a very serious problem in marriages. If you are selfish, you're gonna. I know men. I've seen men, and these were in the church. He had a nice car. He had the best of clothes. He went out to expensive lunches every day, and his kids didn't even have decent shoes to wear. And his wife had to beg to get grocery money. And this happens a lot. She has to just humiliate herself every time she wants to get her hair fixed. And she always went around broke, but not him. He was doing fine. Well, he's still a bachelor. Well, if he wanted to live that way, he should stay single. Well, you got the principle? We may sacrifice our own legitimate sexual privileges. We may stay single, but we may not get married and then sacrifice our wife and children in any way. Okay. We'll move on if there are no other questions.
look at marriage next as a spiritual as well as a physical relationship. The Old Testament interdiction of mixed marriages was aimed not at ethnic miscegenation, but rather against spiritual adultery. That word miscegenation means what? Means mixed marriages. Mixed marriages. Did the Old Testament condemn mixed marriages? Yes. Of what kind? Not racially mixed. The Old Testament doesn't care a thing about the race, what we call race today. Race is a very arbitrary thing. It was a spiritual adultery, a spiritual miscegenation. It was spiritual adultery. In spite of the prohibition against marriages with Moabites, the devotion of the Moabites, Ruth, you got that? The Old Testament, excuse me, one of Jesus' ancestress, Ruth, her husband married her, she married a Moabite, the law said he shouldn't do it. But even with that, the devotion of the Moabites, Ruth, to Naomi and to her God gained her as an honored status as the ancestor of David and of Jesus Christ. Yeah. She said to Naomi, "Your God shall be my God." At that point, apparently God stopped caring that she was a Moabite. Marriages with non-Jews were condemned as leading to spiritual apostasy. I gave you the scriptural citations. You know, you've studied this in other classes. That is, don't marry these women of other religions because they will bring that religion in. And it's interesting. One of the reasons I will not marry and would not, the local church, marry a Christian to a non-Christian, often the Christian, and usually the woman, the girl's minister is the one who usually performs the wedding. The girls always got more flack than the boys did, which I thought was unfair, but I couldn't do anything about it, the jawbone. But one of the reasons why I would not marry a Christian to a non-Christian was you'd be told this, well, if I'll win them. Well, God has a plan for winning the lost. It's called evangelism. It's not called marriage. But the fact is, usually, who wins out, the non-Christian mate or the Christian mate? The non-Christian mate evangelizes the Christian most of the time. Well, the example I give in the syllabus is of Solomon and his many wives. What happened? He corrupted the whole nation. In the post-exilic period, mixed marriages were severely condemned by Ezra and Nehemiah. Remember, they had to get to, when they came home from the captivity, they had to get rid of their foreign wives. Why? Because you cannot maintain the faith of Israel with all these pagan women. The baneful results of intermarriage are evident in the fate of the Israelites from the northern kingdom. They were completely assimilated into the society of their pagan Assyrian captors and became the lost tribes. The New Testament warns against marriages with non-Christians. 2 Corinthians 6:14. Let's look at this. 2 Corinthians 6:14. Do not be bound together with unbelievers, for what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness, or what fellowship has light with darkness? Now, some would protest that marriage is not mentioned there. No, but the principle is there. Talk about not being bound. They say, well, not being bound together with unbelievers means you don't go into business with an unbeliever. Well, so you marry somebody, that's going into business together. That's really going into business together. If the principle holds for going into business with somebody, it certainly holds for getting married, being bound together. But it's more specific. In 1 Corinthians 7:39, we read that. I'm sorry, 1 Corinthians 7:39. Let me say Corinthians. About the advice is to widows, as you'll recall there. Let me get the exact wording here. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. See that? Here's a woman in the church. Her husband dies, Paul says. If her husband's dead, she's free to remarry, as long as it's a Christian, of course. Now, even if the New Testament did not warn about it, hear what I'm going to say now, students. If we did not have these two scriptures, very clear scriptural statements, and the Old Testament principle, which we've looked at, if we didn't have this, we could safely and forthrightly say that for a Christian to marry a non-Christian is absurd by the very nature of Christianity. It's implicit in the very nature of the Christian faith that a Christian would not marry a non-Christian. For instance, if you're a Christian, what you're saying is that Jesus is my very life, isn't he? He's what my life is all about. If my life is all about Jesus, if my one wish in life is to live under the lordship of Jesus, to be a Christian, how can I become one flesh with somebody who's an unbeliever? Do you understand? It's just absurd at the face of it. Now, Ambrose warned, quote, that there can be no unity of love where there is no unity of faith. Tertullian, in his treatise to his wife, Ad Uxorem, listed the problems that a Christian wife encountered when she married a pagan. Her husband objected to her devotions and Christian activities and forced her to perform pagan ceremonies. Tertullian conceded that matters were different when a wife was converted and her mate was not. You got that? That's a different thing. We have a Christian married to a non-Christian because one is converted and one is not. You'll see the difference? It's not a matter of a Christian going out and marrying a pagan, where neither were Christians, and one becomes a Christian. Then you've got a mixed marriage. He conceded that matters were different under this circumstance. He, that is the pagan, would be impressed by her piety. In such cases, I'm reading now, Paul advised the wife to stay with her unbelieving husband for the sake of the children. This is 1 Corinthians 7, 13 and 14. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, you got that? Now keep in mind, he's writing to the Corinthian church, which is a new church. He is not writing to a woman who married a pagan. He's writing to a woman who was a pagan along with her husband, and she was converted and he was not. So the unbelieving husband, a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to live with her, let her not send her husband away. Don't go after a divorce. Send away is an idiom for divorce. Let him not divorce her. Let her not seek a divorce. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified to his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified to her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean, but now they are holy. That's a fancy figurative way of saying there's the influence there. He's not, of course, saying that he doesn't say the unbelieving man is saved by his wife's faith. Doesn't say that, doesn't mean that. But at least you've got the Christian influence there. That's what it means. Peter admonishes the wife to win her husband without a word, that is, by her exemplary behavior. And you can read that in 1 Peter 3, 1 and 2. We know those verses, don't we? Because if a woman's got an unchristian husband, then if he won't listen to you, you live the Christian life before him in such a way that you'll win him without a word. It doesn't mean he won't have to be taught, but he will be brought within listening distance by your life.
Many different places that we deal with, but where in many churches today we deal with people who are not in churches all over against racial, interracial marriage. And obviously the scriptures don't support this.
I mean, they don't forbid interracial marriage, what you're saying. That's right.
It doesn't forbid it.
The Bible in no way is interracial marriage a violation of the will of God, that in and of itself. Might not always be smart in some situations, but that's not wrong. But by the way, there's no such thing as races anyway. There's only one race. The human race. Yes.
When we're speaking of when, like a husband is a non-Christian to Christ without speaking a word by a woman's wife, say the man does not want the woman to go to church, okay, should the woman then decide to do what the Bible says and honor her husband and respect her husband and stay home, or should she continue to go to church, and which one would be the better witness?
that gets iffy. I would say, in general, all the things being equal, the better witness is to go to church. But that gets complicated by the fact that she put herself in that position. If a woman, she loves this good-looking hunk, and she's a Christian. And by the way, guys like Christian girls to marry. They like trashy girls to mess around with. When they're ready to marry, they want one of the good ones. Especially Roman Catholic boys like to marry non-Catholic girls. I'm serious. They'll pick them out and go after them. But if this girl says to him, I'm a Christian, and she knows he's not, and he tells her before the wedding, well, look, I don't want any church going in my house. You marry me, you're going to stay home with me on Sunday. It's my only day off. And she goes ahead and marries him. She really, well, should she go to church? Well, I'd say yes, but she is surely in trouble with God. Because she knew going in. And that happens. That kind of thing happens. Now, it'd be a different case if a woman, neither were Christians, she became a Christian, and she said, I'm a Christian now, and I want to go to church. And he said, well, we've never done that. And she really wants to go. Then I think maybe that's a little different. I think she ought to go still. She needs to go at least once a day, once a week, once on the Lord's Day. But I think God would probably do that differently. Listen, I can't tell you, every minister knows that Jim can verify this. It's amazing how many times, if you're in a minister very long, you get people who come to you with problems that they've got, that they created for themselves. You warned them, either personally or from the pulpit, you told them, they just brazen, defiant, they go into a relationship, and then when the thing starts to fall apart, they come and say, preacher, what am I supposed to do? And frankly, I get a little bit cynical about it. I said, don't you remember I told you about this? Well, yeah, but you know, I thought I could change it. My advice is, sister, you made your bed, live in it, sleep in it. You made your house, live in it. I was raised on the doctrine, every tub sits on its own bottom. Never heard that old expression? That means is, the time comes when you take responsibility for your choices. And if you're old enough to get married, you're old enough to take responsibility for your choices. I, as a preacher, I've got so many things to be guilty of as a person and as a minister. I refuse to be guilty for things I don't have to be guilty for. And if I told somebody, carefully warned them, and they went ahead with it, and then they come whining around to me, I just tell them to go pray about it. We'll talk to God. I don't know. They didn't listen to me. Either. And by the way, I found this. If they don't listen to what you say when you sit in the pulpit, they don't listen when you sit in the office either. The standard I used in performing weddings was the standard I used for church membership. If I would accept them in the church as is, I'll marry them as is. I don't see any other standard to use. It either, you know, that's the same.
I'm dealing with a situation my Kim just brought up about a couple of them that are 20 years. She's been sick for about 5 years now. Her husband found out how I threatened her to be a good person.
Yeah.
But that teenage boy that's 16, and it seems like they're going to stay together just until the year. How to ask for them to. Yeah. So, and she keeps talking to work all the time, I keep encouraging her to hang in there. But at the same time, what this first thing is better than Chris talking about is just for the sake of children. She's better than children.
Yes, I think you know what he's saying. Well, if you go on and apply the principles, you know, fine, go ahead, I'm going to finish your question, don't I?
Well, how long have you got? For the sake of children, how long does that mean for the sake of children?
Until they're raised.
on their own. Well, not that he's on his own. Now, the principle, as I understand the Corinthians, is, and it's because of what Jesus said, according to Matthew 19, that he's saying that he says, to summarize the teaching, as I understand the Corinthians, a woman who has a Christian husband is not a Christian. As long as he'll let you live with him, as long as he'll work with you a little bit, he stays, you keep the marriage together. If he makes your life impossible for you, then separate him, move out. Can't divorce him. Just move out. Live somewhere else. If you have to choose between living with him and your Christianity, if it gets that bad, it's an extreme case. If he divorces you, and gets implied in it, gets another woman, he says, well, I don't want a Christian for a wife. And you wanted to live with him, you wanted to keep it together, and he just divorces you, and, if I say, implied in that, gets another woman, gets another wife, then you're not now. By that I mean you can remarry. But that's the same rule that Jesus gave. He has found another woman. Now, that's what I understand that to be. But I would say in that case, to apply that principle in your case, in the case you mentioned, that she should live with him as long as she can for the sake of the children. When the children are raised, if it becomes impossible for her to maintain her Christianity, at least at some level, her Christian life at some level, and live with him, she should just go live somewhere else. Not divorce him, but just separate him.
So if this guy was to go and get a girlfriend, would he be free to give the divorce on the ground for assault and deadly force?
If he slept with a girlfriend, if he had sex with a girlfriend, if he's adultery, that's what adultery is. Not that she should seek it. I think it would be the last resort. She shouldn't say, aha, get down free. No, she should try to make the marriage work, no matter what. That violates the spirit of it. The Bible doesn't say you have to get a divorce, or it's not to be a pretext, adultery, in the case of adultery. That's the last resort. Yeah. Sanctified means you create, in that context, the children are sanctified, your husband is sanctified, using it in a figurative way, meaning you've got a different kind of situation. You've got a Christian situation. I'm sorry, a situation with Christian influence, as opposed, it's set apart from a purely pagan influence. Any other questions or comments? When we come to this, we're about to come to the end. Well, this hour went fast, didn't it? Wish y'all would be quiet and let me lecture more. Not really. These are good questions, and I appreciate them. Well, it's a good place to break, because we now come to the fact that marriage calls for Christ-like love and concern. We want to be sure to have a good crowd tomorrow. So we're going to have guests in here. We're going to talk about wife being subjected to their husband. So when all the men, all the husbands are still over here, I'm going to need an amen corner.